Bonjour, and welcome to Bon Appetit on Zen Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer broadcaster, Ellen Ward. Today I'll be reading from the March 2025 issue. First up, Editor-in-Chief Jamila Robinson shares what's on her mind this month. Dominique Crin recently visited the Bon Appetit test kitchen to show us the most challenging recipe she's ever created. She executed complicated techniques with liquid nitrogen that were all the rage a decade ago. These days, she dazzles diners with innovative ways to cook mostly seafood and vegetables and focuses on sustainable farming practices. During our conversation for the Food People podcast, she explained that she had eliminated many animal products, including dairy, from her 3 Michelin-starred restaurant, Atelier Crin, until she found Bay Area suppliers who shared her values around kinder environmental practices. Like many creative people, Chef Crin lives in the future. Her vision for a sustainable organic food system is coming to fruition through the bounty of her Blue Bell farm and being shared with diners through her restaurant menus. It can take years of patience for everyday audiences to experience the impact of food science, technology, and research, and even longer for companies and distributors to catch up. That's why, in this issue, we wanted to explore innovation in the culinary industry. Consider Rose 7, the company co-founded by Dan Barber, which focuses on growing produce for flavor. Its first star was Honey Nut, a sweeter, smaller cousin to butternut squash, now common at specialty stores and farmers markets. Though the concept is very simple, the innovation of creating seeds that produce more nutritious and flavorful vegetables helps to shift the industry forward. Contributor Ali Bazzari makes the case that we are living in the future of food. We are already experiencing the impact of satellite imagery to reduce overuse of crop fertilization, leading to better produce on grocery store shelves and kitchens. In dining, some restaurants are already using AI and other personalization and machine learning to help manage a busy service and book those elusive reservations. Technology also helps bridge the past and present, cooking techniques and culture. Our editors have fallen back in love with steaming, and in South Carolina, culinary entrepreneurs are preserving traditional foodways. As the arc of food innovation bends toward more people benefiting from research and creativity, it will be exciting to see how the way we eat evolves alongside those changes. Here are 3 seafood innovators. Angel León, the chief explorer of Oponiente in El Puerto de Santa Maria, Spain, reconsiders how all the fish can be incorporated into a tasting menu. Next, Demi Johnson, the high schooler, was recently honored by the National Geographic Society for her work to restore the oyster population in Mississippi. And finally, Josh Nyland, the Australian chef, specializes in reimagined fish flavors, including a chocolate cake that began as a paste made from fish bones. Now, Hannah Osbrink shares some table talk with Just Add Water. A new generation of instant foods combines effortless preparation with sophisticated taste. Just Add Water. What comes to mind when you read those instructions? Perhaps a styrofoam cup of freeze-dried noodles evoking late-night study sessions, or a foil pouch of dehydrated vegetables destined for space travel. If antiquated images like these happen to be your reference points, we're happy to report that the world of instant foods that just need a pour of water has come a long way. The biggest improvements? Variety and taste. Now you can start your day with a rich, dark cup of Morning Joe from a mere tube of paste, or a gut-friendly oatmeal more flavorful than the usual super sweet instant packets. For meals, you can feast on a traditional Korean seaweed soup that reconstitutes in just 2 minutes, or a spiced kichari who whose deep flavor belies its speedy cooking time. These convenient products push the notion of what instant meals can be, with no dilution, no pun intended, in quality. First, no normal coffee dark roast. This Swiss coffee brand is great for outdoor adventures on the go, letting you enjoy a quick cup without the hassle of brewing equipment. I just mix a teaspoon with half a cup of hot or cold water, and voila! The dark roast offers delightful notes of chocolate, and the beet sugar gives the extra kick you need for that morning hike. Although it's fantastic for the outdoors, I've also started drinking it at home and squeezing it into my favorite smoothies. Hazel Zavala, art director. Second, Paro Kichari. I always keep a box of this kachari stashed in my pantry. With about a 30-minute cook time, no need to rinse or pre-soak the beans or rice, and a short ingredient list, basmati rice, mung beans, and spices such as cumin, turmeric, and cardamom. It's my quick ticket to a warming meal that tastes rich and complex, but requires zero thought on my part. It works as a side for a larger meal, but I also love eating it on its own with a spoonful of chili crisp or the brand's jarred taka oil drizzled on top. Elena Chu, commerce writer. Third, quite nice breakfast oats. Most mornings I'm running out the door and want to have a nourishing breakfast at my desk that I still look forward to. Quite Nice's breakfast oats save the day here. The single serving packets contain oats packed with fiber and protein, plus add-ins like chia seeds and hulled buckwheat for a hearty, chewy texture. You can enjoy them instantly by adding hot water, or make overnight oats by stirring in cold water or milk and chilling them in the fridge while you sleep. Kate Kasson, Editorial Operations Manager. And fourth, Oma Natural Seaweed Soup. Korean seaweed soup is a cozy dish long heralded for its nutritive properties. These dehydrated miyokak cubes are made with natural seaweed and beef bone broth. Unlike many sodium-filled instant soups, Oma's, named after the Korean word for mother, tastes as close as you'll get to homemade, balanced, well-seasoned, and utterly comforting. After rehydrating the block with a cup of boiling water, let it sit covered for 2 minutes before stirring. Add steamed rice for the full Korean effect. Hannah Asbrink, Deputy Food Director. If you're feeling hungry, here's a recipe for the ultimate tuna melt. One of 56 recipes handpicked by the Bon Appetit editors that you must make this year. Why we love it. I've lived a life punctuated by tuna melts. First in my mom's kitchen, always open-faced, cheese still bubbling from the broiler. Later, at countless diners and in my own apartment. I therefore feel credentialed in saying that Zainab Issa's ultimate tuna melt is the dish at its zenith. Dill, celery, and red onion add crunch and color. Lemon juice and brine from either capers or pickled jalapenos add the right amount of acid and salt without overshadowing the tuna itself. And by griddling it like a grilled cheese, your melt gets that old-school lunch counter finish. Sure, a recipe for a sandwich might be riffable by nature, but this is the formula, including those chips on the side, at its very best. Wilder Davies. 4 servings. 1 small red onion, finely chopped. 1 celery stalk, finely chopped. 1/2 cup mayonnaise, preferably Kewpie. 1/3 cup finely chopped dill. 1 tablespoon drained capers or chopped pickled jalapenos, plus 1 tablespoon brine. 1 tablespoon fresh lemon juice. 1 7-ounce jar oil-packed tuna fillets or 1.5 5-ounce cans oil-packed tuna drained. Freshly ground pepper. 2 tablespoons unsalted butter, room temperature. 8 slices Pullman or sourdough bread. 4 slices American cheese or sharp cheddar. Dill pickles, kettle-style potato chips, and hot sauce for serving. Mix red onion, celery, mayonnaise, dill, capers, and lemon juice in a medium bowl to combine. Add tuna and mix in, breaking up with a fork. Season generously with pepper. Taste for salt and add up to 1 tablespoon brine as needed. Spread butter over one side of each slice of bread, dividing evenly. Turn bread buttered side down. Place a slice of cheese on 4 slices of bread. Divide tuna mixture evenly over cheese. Close up sandwiches with remaining 4 bread slices, arranging buttered side up. Heat a large cast iron skillet over medium. Working in batches if needed, place sandwiches, cheese side down, in skillet and cook, turning once and pressing down with a spatula to ensure good contact with skillet until bread is golden brown and crisp and cheese is melted, about 4 minutes per side. If using cheddar, cover the pan after turning the sandwiches to ensure cheese melts completely. Transfer sandwiches to a cutting board and slice in half. Serve with pickles and potato chips doused with hot sauce on the side. Feeling thirsty? The future is co-fermented. If you love wine, fruit, or cider, these easy-drinking, sustainably made bottles are for you. By Osa de Babur Winter. In the wide world of drinks, co-ferments are the Wild West, a new frontier, unbound to any rules and super exciting. As winemakers grapple with climate change and a growing preference for low-alcohol beverages, these buzzy pours represent a new direction, both in flavor and industry impact. Made by letting grape juice ferment alongside juice from apples, quince, or cherries and other fruit, co-ferments are hard to categorize but easy to enjoy. Is it wine? Is it cider? Who cares? At Wild Arc Farm, in New York's Hudson Valley, winemaker Todd Cavallo has been using co-ferments to broaden the conversation about what counts as wine since 2018. Cavallo and other winemakers see the blending style as an insurance policy against the mounting threat of climate change. In years where there are frosts or major crop issues for grapes, people have leaned more toward making ciders or co-ferments, he explains. If we can't make wine one year, we still have to survive. The resilience from having a broader palette of fruits to work with is beneficial. Apples are ultimately cheaper than wine grapes, which means people who use them together have less at stake financially, says Aaron Brown of Sonoma-based Bardo Cider, which produces several wines in this style, widely known as fruit-grape co-ferments. They can use natural yeast, they can let fermentation take time, and that's what's fun about making these wines. Co-ferments are especially popular with drinkers looking for light, glow-style, low-alcohol drinks. Co-ferments were wild for. Ashtana Virga Morada, 2021. Helzberg, California, winemaking duo Chinua Ashton-Lewis and Will Basanta created this Syrah and Pinot Noir blend sourced from the Ashton family vineyard in Sonoma Valley, with Gravenstein apple juice from nearby Bardo Cider. The resulting wine sings with bright notes of sour cherries and raspberries before making way for a striking earthy finish. $32, ashwantawines.com. Revel Cider Soif. At just 6% ABV, Soif would be super drinkable even if it didn't taste like the first day of summer. A blend of 2 ciders aged on cherries and strawberries with a hit of red wine skins for added body, this dry and tart rosé-esque bottle from Ontario, Canada, is the definition of a crowd pleaser at an accessible price point. $18, revelcider.com. La Montañuela Los Enamorados, 2021. Mentored by famed natural wine drinkers Deirdre Heekin and Kayla Barbara, Colombian Camila Carrillo celebrates Vermont's orchard fruit bounty. Los Enamorados uses 26 apple varieties native to the region, with a backbone of La Crescent, a white grape packing peach and apricot notes, dancing alongside pineapple and honey notes from Frontenac Gris. $58, thirstmerchants.com. Barpos St. Capura. Sonoma, California, Barpos Cider often works with older orchards and upcycled grapes. The team runs aged apple cider over pomace, the stems, pulp, and skins left behind after pressing grapes for wine from Bucklin and Bedrock wineries. This is a slightly fizzy sip with dried cranberry and dehydrated strawberry flavors, plus bold earthy notes from Grenache and Syrah. $23, thirstmerchants.com. Next up, High Speed. Your microwave is the key to a delicious dinner in T-minus 5 minutes, by Emma LaPerruque. There is a microwave in nearly 90% of U.S. homes, so why is it often seen as a cooking sidekick? This humble appliance can do a lot more than reheat leftovers or perk up that forgotten cup of tea. Chef Lucas Sim, for instance, uses a microwave to steam fish. Senior service editor Kelsey Jane Youngman swears by it to toast pecans, and lately I've been using mine for a lightning-fast tofu to round out weeknight meals. Steaming is a classic way of waking up tofu's subtle flavor and leaning into its custardy texture. The microwave accomplishes a similar feat with fewer dishes. Nuking a block expels some of the water content. That's why many people microwave tofu as an alternative to pressing, and primes it for seasoning. In this recipe, that's as simple as butter and soy sauce. As butter melts, silken tofu welcomes it with open arms, soaking up the golden goodness. European-style butter is the move for its higher fat content. I like Kerrygold's grassy flavor and yellow hue. From there, all you need is a splash of soy sauce. Avoid anything labeled as low sodium or light. We want something robust to complement tofu's modesty. A scatter of cilantro and scallion go a long way, though if you only have one or the other, I have a hunch you'll be just as satisfied. For the few minutes and zero skill it takes to pull off this dish, it can be dinner, and done with a starchy side like a hunk of bread, tangle of noodles, or mound of rice. The last of which deputy food editor Hannah Osbrink also makes in the microwave, a bright idea indeed. Here is the recipe for microwave tofu with butter and soy sauce. Scoop 1 16-ounce package silken tofu into a microwave-safe bowl. Try to keep it intact, but don't worry if it breaks into a few pieces. Microwave on high until hot, about 3 minutes. Using a large spoon or small plate to hold back tofu, pour off liquid and bowl into sink. You can also scoop out liquid with a large spoon. Don't worry about getting every last drop. Top tofu with 2 tablespoons salted European-style butter, thinly sliced, and microwave until butter is melted, about 30 seconds. Drizzle with 1 tablespoon soy sauce, not low sodium. Then top with cilantro leaves with tender stems and or thinly sliced scallions, and season with freshly ground pepper, if desired, 2 to 4 servings. Hannah Osbrink, deputy food director, says, "When I want perfect rice at the ready, I turn to my favorite cooked instant rice, Korean hetbahn. After a 90-second spin in the microwave, it's a reliable partner to time-saving meals. These convenient, individually portioned containers promise plump, glistening rice that you'd be hard-pressed to differentiate from freshly steamed. They're available at cj.co.kr/en/brands/hetbahn.com. And now for the answers to those burning questions. The internet's favorite heat miser on how hot ones changed the celeb interview for the better, by Sam Stone. You'll never hear Sean Evans slander chicken wings or hot sauce, even if he's tired of eating them. The 38-year-old host and co-creator of Hot Ones is now in his 10th year of shooting the YouTube interview show, in which he and a celebrity guest each eat 10 wings coated in increasingly spicy hot sauces. In 25 seasons, over 350 episodes, and nearly 4,000 Sun Hot chicken wings, Evans has interviewed musicians, actors, and comedians alike, grilling them with questions about life and work as they push the limits of the Scoville scale on the human palate. Gordon Ramsay cursed violently. Aubrey Plaza snorted a glass of milk. Pedro Pascal sweated profusely. Don't get us started on the eerily nonplussed reactions of Lorde and Ariana Grande. Amassing more than 4 billion views and 14 million subscribers, Evans and his team created a phenomenon, evolving the talk show genre along the way. Hot Ones hit another milestone last year. BuzzFeed, which acquired the show in 2021, sold First We Feast, the show's parent company, to a group of investors, including Evans himself. As Hot Ones enters its 26th season, we put one of the most well-known interviewers of the social media era in the hot seat, learning about his interview process, why the Hot Ones format succeeds, and what makes a great hot sauce. How does it feel to be on the interviewee side of the table? Sean Evans: I am much more comfortable on your side of the table than on this side of the table. As a host, I've worked hard on trying to just sit back and let the flow state take over. Do you get into a flow state as you interview on Hot Ones? SE: Yeah, it catches the track on wing 3 or 4. You can see at that point if you're going to start to win this person over. Even though you're dealing with huge stars and some of the most confident people, there is something about eating this gauntlet of fiery chicken wings in the bizarre context of it being on a TV show with 4 cameras pointed at you. We have to create this chemistry, this rapport, this energy, and this rhythm, and everything stacked against you to do that. A couple wings in is where it starts to catch the rhythm. How has the show changed over its 10 years? SE: The show hasn't changed at all. It's the same set. It's the same bald guy with his questions and the lineup of hot sauces. Personally, I've changed. I can't watch stuff from the first 3, 4, or 5 years. When I look back on it, I'm wincing. I don't think it was a great interview show in the beginning. I was young. I was green. I look back and I'm projecting and moving a lot. The show had this cult audience early on, and it really motivated me to look at this as not only a unique concept, but also to try to make what is unimpeachably an excellent interview show. How has the talk show landscape changed since Hot Ones began? SE: When we started, there weren't that many interview shows on the internet. Now there are a million, and there are so many podcasts now. We were able to do this rose in the concrete thing because we weren't competing against much, to be honest. Back in the beginning, I felt like we were the only ones on the beach. You could do a late night show, but then it wouldn't be novel. If somebody was doing the internet interview of record, they would go to Hot Ones, whereas now there are dozens of places to go. How do the wings and hot sauces affect the interview? SE: The wings, the gauntlet, the format in general, I think they play in 2 ways. One, simply as an activity. If you're doing an activity, it takes your mind a little bit off of the formality of sitting down and talking to someone. And 2, because when you eat the bomb beyond insanity, there's no way that you can remember your media training. When celebrities come in, they're in a PR-driven flight pattern. The scorching hot wings take celebrities who are on a pedestal and knock them down to a level that everyone knows, dying on hot sauce. It's an equalizing experience, and in that moment, I think it truly reveals who this person is. Has your understanding of celebrity changed in your decade of interviewing on Hot Ones? SE: It used to be this sort of exclusive club by definition, a lifestyle that was unobtainable. Now everyone's a celebrity. Now there's so many different categories and so many different things. TikTok and streaming, IRL streaming, those didn't even exist as platforms when we started this show. And now they've birthed an entire new celebrity class, an entire new influencer class, and that's just in this decade. So it's like, well, what's going to happen in the next decade? What makes a great hot sauce? SE. I like a sweet heat situation. I like the way that it can Trojan horse in the heat. Some pineapple, some apricot, something that kind of brings in the heat as sort of an after effect. Because I feel like the trail that heat leaves behind is so much better than the punch that it meets you with immediately. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you, flats or drums? SE. I started off as a drum man. There's just something about it that is easy to eat. It has a built-in handle. But over the years, I've actually become more of a flat man. I enjoy the ritual of splitting and tearing bones. Anecdotally, I think that the meat is more tender and better on a flat than it is on a drum. I've come to prefer it. I'll conclude today with jasmine, a little something to sip on from Epicurious's vast archives. Recipe by Paul Harrington. In 1993, Matt Jasmine, a dishwasher at famed Chez Panisse, stopped into townhouse in Emeryville, California, and asked bartender Paul Harrington to make him something new. Harrington had been reading 1947's Trader Vic's Bartender's Guide, where he'd come across a cocktail called the Pegu Club, an electric combination of gin, curacao, lime juice, and bitters. A full bowl of lemons on the bar inspired Harrington to substitute them for the lime juice, and Cointreau took the place of curacao, another orange-flavored liqueur. Why not switch out the classic bitters for Campari, he asked himself. Thus, a new classic, lightly floral and citrusy, was born as the jasmine. Sam Stone. Here's how you make it. Combine 1.5 ounces gin, 3/4 ounce fresh lemon juice, 1/4 ounce Campari, and 1/4 ounce Cointreau in a cocktail shaker half filled with ice. Cover. Shake until outside is frosty, about 15 seconds. Strain into a chilled glass, garnish with ice and a lemon twist. Makes one. Reprinted with permission from Modern Classic Cocktails. 60 plus stories and recipes from the new Golden Age in Drinks by Robert Simpson. Copyright 2022. Published by 10 Speed Press, an imprint of Penguin Random House. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Bon Appetit on Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is your volunteer reader, Ellen Ward, saying au revoir until next time.